It is Friday, August 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Senator John McCain is remembered at a service at the U.S. Capitol Rotunda.
This is one of the bravest souls our nation has ever produced.
Pope Francis is said to be serene despite allegations surrounding various child abuse scandals in the Catholic Church, and a former U.S. president and his wife build houses in hope with Habitat for Humanity. It's all ahead. Senator John McCain was remembered Friday at a memorial service in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. McCain died last Saturday at age 81 after a year-long battle with brain cancer. President Donald Trump was not invited to Friday's ceremony or McCain's funeral on Saturday, a decision viewed by many as a rebuke of Trump. A bitter feud between Trump and the two-time presidential hopeful took root during Trump's 2016 campaign when he mocked McCain for getting captured during the Vietnam War and said McCain was not a war hero. At the Capitol, Vice President Mike Pence said one of McCain's memoirs was entitled Faith of Our Fathers.
John McCain held firm to that faith, the faith of his fathers, through dungeons, fire, and sword. And he held fast to his faith in America through six decades of service.
Speaker of the House Paul Ryan said he will always honor McCain.
I think ahead to the day when I, like so many, will bring my own children and perhaps their children to that hallowed lawn in Annapolis. I think about that. I think about what I might say to them. This is one of the bravest souls our nation has ever produced.
Ambassador Kurt Volker is the executive director of the McCain Institute for International Leadership. I asked him about the impact McCain had on the U.S. relationship with Vietnam.
First off, he had the credibility both with the American military and conservatives to stand up for the idea of opening relations with Vietnam. He had respect from the Vietnamese government and people because he was willing to do that. He was willing to overcome the past. He started, in a way, together with John Kerry, but it was John McCain's commitment to get a full accounting of prisoners of war and soldiers and sailors who were missing in action as was possible. And that was a condition for the ability to open relations with Vietnam. So he brought both his military experience, his credibility from all sides, and his commitment to pushing it through to get to a place where you could actually then renew a relationship between the two countries.
Well, another country that Senator McCain was known for being very opinionated about is Russia. He was always a strong critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin. There was that famous remark that he made when former President George W. Bush said he looked at Putin and looked into his soul. And Senator McCain said he looked into Putin's eyes and saw KGB, referring to Putin's earlier career. How did Senator McCain impact relations with Russia?
Well, several things. First off, I think he saw very clearly what Putin was doing. He was building an authoritarian approach to rule at home, and that leads inevitably to an aggressive foreign policy as well. And McCain could see it coming. He understood what Vladimir Putin was doing. He didn't hesitate to call it out early on. And then he also very strongly supported those countries that were victims of Russian aggression, such as Georgia or Ukraine.
Senator McCain was known, of course, for the more recent Iraq war. He was a supporter of the war, and he was later on a strong supporter of the surge. However, in his recent book, The Restless Wave, Senator McCain called this war a mistake and referred to the fact that the reason for the war was all because of the reports of weapons of mass destruction that was later found out not to be true. So that was something that, you know, he supported, but later on he changed his mind about it.
Well, that's exactly right. And if you can put yourself back into 2002, 2003, there was an overwhelming concern in this country that the terrorists who attacked us on 9/11 were actively seeking to acquire weapons of mass destruction. And there was a belief that Saddam Hussein both had those weapons and would have been willing to make them available to terrorists. As we know now, that was wrong. He didn't have the weapons. And therefore, the intelligence and the premise on which we went into that conflict was wrong. And also, the execution of that was wrong. And we left an extraordinary amount of devastation and mistakes along the way. So he, among many people, including Hillary Clinton and others, all supported the war when it began. And I think over time, come to realize that the premises were wrong and the costs of that war were far too high for the Iraqi people.
The United States and the McCain Institute now goes ahead without Senator John McCain. However, I'm sure your institute, how will it continue to promote the policies and interests that sure. John McCain followed during his lifetime?
Right. Well, we are very fortunate that we were set up about 6.5 years ago, early 2012, as a part of Arizona State University and separate both legally and functionally from the senator's daily work. So we are inspired by the values and character that he demonstrated and the legacy of leadership that he and his family have shown. But our work has always stood on its own legs. And with that, we are promoting values and character-driven leadership. We have a program of next-generation leaders for that purpose. We are also acting as a do tank in different areas. We try to create programmatic activity where we can accomplish things ourselves. That's different than being a think tank where you make recommendations of what other people should do. We've carried out programming in the areas of combating human trafficking, in promoting human rights and democracy, and advancing global rule of law and governance. And we are launching this year a program on combating terrorism and violent extremism. So we will be continuing to develop these programs and go forward with that guiding vision of advancing character-driven leadership overall.
Ambassador Kurt Volker, the Executive Director of the McCain Institute for International Leadership. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The U.S. rallies India to tackle pressing security issues and to curb its oil imports from Iran. German Chancellor Angela Merkel wraps up an Africa tour with talk of business and migration. President Trump threatens to withdraw from the World Trade Organization. And Ugandan police shut down the capital after an opposition figure is rearrested. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In July 2015, NASA's New Horizons spacecraft provided scientists an amazing once-in-a-lifetime look at the distant dwarf planet Pluto. After the successful flyby, the New Horizons team requested and was granted an extension of their mission through 2021 so that it can explore other Kuiper Belt objects, or KBOs. The Outer Solar System Exploring spacecraft was then sent on a path toward a Kuiper Belt object called 2014 MU69, or Ultima Thule, which is some 1.6 billion kilometers from Pluto. Now at a distance of about 161 million kilometers, the spacecraft recently made its first detection of its target. NASA says this first detection is important since continuing observations will help the mission team fine-tune the spacecraft's approach to its planned close encounter with Ultima Thule on New Year's Day 2019. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the late singer Aretha Franklin is remembered at her funeral in Detroit. Pope Francis was described Thursday by a top aide as serene in the face of the unprecedented public skirmishing breaking out among Catholic prelates over an explosive charge that the pontiff knew about sexual misconduct allegations against a U.S. cardinal but chose to ignore them. The Vatican Secretary of State said Francis is maintaining his grace despite bitterness and concern in the Vatican over the accusation leveled against him by a one-time top Catholic envoy who has demanded the Pope resign. Reporter Jamie Detmer in Rome tells me about the Pope's reaction to the report.
yesterday, the Vatican Secretary of State, who's a close aide, of course, to the Pope, was saying that he was serene, even in the face of this rather unprecedented public skirmishing breaking out between Catholic prelates over the explosive charge, that there is, he acknowledged, some concern and bitterness about the allegations, and kind of left it at that. I mean, what is prompting a lot of anxiety is that the Pope himself and his supporters, his close aides, are not engaging with the details, the substance of the allegation made by Archbishop Carlo Mario Vigano. The reason they're saying they're doing that is because they feel that it will dignify the allegation if they respond, and that they feel that they can ride out the storm. But this looks increasingly unlikely. The pressure really is on the Pope to answer the central allegation, particularly from American bishops and prelates. The Pope's getting a lot of support, by the way, from Latin America, from cardinals there who are saying the Pope will soon respond. But the reverberations of this are extraordinary, and there's an underpinning, really, to all of this, of a clash between traditionalists and conservatives who really have disapproved of the Pope's more inclusive message and more progressive forces who are backing the Pope.
What is known about the Pope's accuser, this Archbishop of Vigano? What has his history with the Church been like?
He's mainly been a diplomat. He was the top Vatican ambassador to the U.S. for many years, and really was basically dismissed about 2016 by the Pope, who I think felt that he was, or the suggestion is that he was, you know, quite a traditionalist, quite a conservative, and an opponent of the Pope's strategy of inclusiveness. He predates, obviously, this Pope. He had a reasonably close relationship with the previous Pope, Benedict XVI. And I ought to add that today, a close aide to Benedict has denied the substance of the charge that Vigano has leveled against Francis.
And what about the reaction from abuse survivors to this archbishop?
Mixed reaction. I mean, a lot of abuse survivor spokesmen have said that they feel that Vigano and the circle of conservative prelates, bishops, and Catholic writers around him are basically exploiting the abuse scandal that, you know, predates Francis and has been going on for decades, really, roiling the Church. And another element which has disturbed some of the abuse survivors is an underlying hint of homophobia, really, in what Vigano is saying. In his explosive 11-page document released last Sunday, coinciding with a trip to Ireland, the Pope's trip to Ireland, Vigano suggested that there was a homosexual current right at the top, in the upper echelons of the Catholic Church, and laid the blame for the abuse scandal that's been going on for decades, really, with that element. He called it basically a gay cabal, a gay mafia. And a lot of abuse survivors feel that there's an element of homophobia to that, which they reject. Now, that one ought to add, there is also frustration amongst the abuse survivors with the current Pope, with Francis, because the feeling is, even though he's apologizing for the past behavior of, as we find out, hundreds of priests, he's not really taking enough concrete action, they feel, to get to the bottom of what has been happening and also to prevent it happening again in the future.
Well, meanwhile, today in Australia, the Catholic Church there rejected a recommendation by a government inquiry that priests be required to report evidence of child sex abuse disclosed in confessionals.
Yes, I mean, the Australian Catholic hierarchy is saying that they have got to preserve the confessional. They've got to preserve the secrecy of the confession. Otherwise, people will stop going for confession. They have, in defense of them, accepted 98% of the recommendations that were made, have been made by the Royal Commission on this. But I'm sure that's going to turn into quite a political battle in Australia about their rejecting that recommendation.
Jamie Detmer reporting from Rome. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton, his wife Hillary Clinton, Reverend Jesse Jackson, and a host of musicians gathered in Detroit to remember singer Aretha Franklin, a giant in the world of American music. The ceremony at the Greater Grace Temple assumed epic proportions, with a program of speakers and music scheduled to last more than 5 hours. Franklin, who died of pancreatic cancer at age 76, has been dressed in four outfits as her body was in state for public viewing over several days. While the week has been filled with tribute concerts and other high-profile celebrations of the singer and her remarkable life, funeral organizers say Friday's funeral is a religious service, not entertainment. Singer Ariana Grande sang a rendition of one of Franklin's greatest hits, A Natural Woman. Franklin will be buried in a bronze casket plated with 24-karat gold. Franklin's name and the title Queen of Soul are embroidered into the champagne-colored velvet lining the interior. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. It's an event that takes place just one week a year, but former President Jimmy Carter and former First Lady Rosalynn Carter's Habitat for Humanity work project has become one of the most identifiable aspects of their legacy. As VOA's Kane Faraba reports outside South Bend, Indiana, it's been an emotional journey for the Carters and their growing army of volunteers.
The sound of construction is music to the ears of country music star Garth Brooks.
That sound you're hearing right there, man, that's love.
For single mother Erica Santiestepan, it's the sound of hope.
I feel like I won the lotto. It means everything. Like, I don't have to worry about where am I going to go next.
That's because when the trusses Brooks is working on are finally raised, it will form the roof over Santiestepan's new home.
So I usually don't ever win anything, and today I'm winning it all. So.
But she isn't getting anything for free. Santiestepan will have a mortgage, an affordable one thanks to Habitat for Humanity's no-interest loan, paid for by her own sweat equity.
Homeowners put in 250 hours of sweat equity. It's a hand up, not a handout.
Country music singer Trisha Yearwood and her husband, Garth Brooks, are two volunteers among hundreds building houses in this Habitat for Humanity Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter work project, which the former president and first lady started in 1984.
Since they got involved, we've been able to partner with 13.2 million people to have new, rehabbed, or repaired homes. And right now we're at a pace that we're partnering with a family somewhere in the world every 50 seconds. And there's really no one that has had more to do with that in terms of building the reputation of Habitat than President and Mrs. Carter.
Not intense heat nor advanced age. Not even cancer has kept them from building houses across the United States and 14 countries, working alongside volunteers like Suzanne Taylor.
And he said once that he's going to do as much as he can with as much as he can for as long as he can because his faith demands it. And I think it's a lesson to all of us to maybe get off the couch a couple more times and go do something to make the world a better place.
Every human being probably would like some excitement in their life, some challenge in their life, some particular thing for which they are grateful in the future, some obstacle to overcome, some things of which they can be proud. And Habitat answers all those questions for me.
Erica Santiestepan didn't know anything about the Carters before the project began, but now she'll be living in a community built in part by the Carters' compassion.
Without them, I couldn't do it. I wouldn't have this. I wouldn't know where I would be next year. So I'm so grateful, like from the bottom of my heart.
Just to see the expression on their face, they start crying first, and then I start crying right behind them. So it's a matter of deep emotion for me on occasion, and I'm already kind of emotional about this project, as you can probably tell.
A project that will put 23 new homes on the map of Mishawaka, Indiana, this year, joining over 4,000 more, built since 1984 by a former president who grew up in a house with no running water or electricity. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Mishawaka, Indiana.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In an effort to encourage the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, to dismantle its nuclear weapons program, the United Nations Security Council last year passed Resolution 2375, which imposes sanctions on North Korea. The United States is determined to strictly implement this resolution. Members of the UN Security Council, and by extension all UN member states, have unanimously agreed to fully enforce sanctions on North Korea, and we expect them to continue to honor those commitments, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
When sanctions are not enforced, the prospects for the successful denuclearization of North Korea are diminished. Right now, North Korea is illegally smuggling petroleum products into the country at a level that far exceeds the quotas established by the United Nations. These illegal ship-to-ship transfers are the most prominent means by which this is happening.
On August 21st, the U.S. Department of the Treasury issued sanctions against two Russian shipping companies for the transfer of refined petroleum products to North Korean vessels and six vessels associated with those firms. The sanctions are pursuant to Executive Order 13810 of September 21, 2017, which targets persons involved in the ship-to-ship transfer of refined petroleum products with North Korean-flagged vessels, an activity expressly prohibited by the UN Security Council. The two companies are Primoria Maritime Logistics Company Limited and Gudzon Shipping Company LLC. Both are based in the Russian port of Vladivostok. Among the six Russian-flagged sanctioned vessels is the Patriot, which conducted two ship-to-ship transfers of oil in early 2018, 1,500 tons to the North Korea-flagged vessel Chungrim II, and another 2,000 tons to the North Korean-flagged ship Chunmasan. The buyer was the Taesung Bank, a North Korean entity that has previously been sanctioned by both the U.S. and the U.N. Ship-to-ship transfers with North Korean-flagged vessels from Russia or elsewhere of any goods being supplied, sold, or transferred to or from North Korea are prohibited under the UN Security Council resolutions on North Korea and are sanctionable under U.S. law, said Secretary of the Treasury Steven Mnuchin in a written statement. Consequences for violating these sanctions will remain in place until we have achieved the final, fully verified denuclearization of North Korea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.